This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Eek. Colorectal cancer still ranks high among cancers affecting Malaysians and is still being diagnosed at late stages. How does this affect patients' treatment and their outcome? And how can we improve early detection of colorectal cancer? And also, you know, what are the advances in treatment that show promise in treating colorectal cancer? To answer all of these questions, we have in the studio with us Dato' Dr. Tan Hak Ju, consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist from St. Gil GI Medical Center in order to find out more. Good afternoon, Dato' Tan. How are you today?
I'm good.
To start with, I think, the basics, Dato', could you give us a description, a definition of colorectal cancer? Because I think it's important to understand what parts of the body they affect.
Colorectal cancer, as the name implies, it basically is the last part of your digestive system. So you have from the anus, you go up, then you go into the rectum. So that bit is important because a lot of patients will have rectal cancer. Then from the rectum, then you go up to the sigmoid colon and descending colon, transverse colon, ascending colon, cecum, and ascending colon and cecum is where your small intestine and the large intestine join. So you can literally have cancer along any of those areas.
Yeah. So if you go from the bottom top, from the anus to the small and large intestines, and how does the cancer generally develop?
Normally, it starts as a polyp. Polyp is a growth. This growth, normally, they are benign to start with. And if you have a benign polyp, you give them time, then some of this polyp eventually will become cancerous. All the colorectal cancers start as a polyp, but not all polyp become cancer.
Right.
There are different types of benign polyp. Some important, some not so important. Some definitely will become cancer. Some definitely won't become cancer.
I see. And what are the factors that would predispose a polyp to become cancerous?
The name itself is very important. So in the benign polyp, you have a hyperplastic polyp, you have inflammatory polyp. They are not so important. Then you have tubular adenoma, you have tubular villous adenoma, you have villous adenoma, you have serrated adenoma. So all these other polyps, they are very important because all of these can become cancerous.
I see. Is it quite typical for a person in their lifetime to develop polyps in the colon?
It is very common for anyone to develop polyp. That's why it is important to find polyp before they become big and become cancerous. The thing about polyp is they normally don't have any symptom. So patients have absolutely no symptom when they have polyp. They will have no symptom when they have early cancer. Most patients will only experience cancers when they are in stage 2, 3, or 4.
I see. And what would those symptoms be?
Depending on the location of the cancer. I said to you just now, if it is polyp, then it can be anywhere, but really you don't really have any symptom. But if you are going to talk about symptoms of cancer, then it depends very much on the location. Let's say if they are near the anus, in the rectum, in the rectal area, commonest symptom for that would be bleeding. So many of these patients will have rectal bleeding. This sometimes can be confused with hemorrhoid. A lot of the patients, you know, when they come to see us, they have bleeding from the back passage. Then they will say, "Doctor, I have a hemorrhoid. Can you try and sort out my hemorrhoid?" And then you ask them, "Why do you think you have hemorrhoid?" Because my friend has PR bleed or rectal bleeding, and he has been diagnosed as hemorrhoid. And therefore, because I have the same symptom, therefore I also have hemorrhoid.
Right.
But many a time you know that this is not really the case, especially when these people are a bit older. But you see, cancer can affect any age group, although majority they are much older, but it doesn't mean that if you are younger, then you can't have colorectal cancer.
And that's one of the trends that's, in the US at least, they're seeing more colorectal cancers among younger people. Are we seeing a similar trend here?
We are. In fact, if you look at the National Cancer Registry, we actually have, like, you know, all the other countries, we also have cancer that tend to happen after they are 50 years old, but we also have quite a significant number of patients who are in their 40s, even younger. My youngest patient is actually 15 years old.
Is that a genetic-related condition?
For those people who presented earlier, much earlier, many of these people, they tend to have a family history. There are a few conditions that will predispose you to colorectal cancer. One of them is this familial adenoma polyposis coli.
Okay.
So these are the people with genetic predisposition for polyp.
Right.
And these people, if we find them, our recommendation normally is to advise them to remove the colon before they become cancerous.
Right, the entire
colon.
I see.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's I suppose that's probably a lot less rare than the lifestyle related colorectal cancer.
Yeah, all these are genetic. They are not related to lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, most people they don't get cancer at such a young age.
Mm.
Most people they tend to get polyp and cancer at a older age group.
Older age, yeah.
Normally, it typically happen in people who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s. Those are the commonest age group.
Okay. And coming back to the symptoms of cancer, which usually, as you said, arise in stages 2, 3, or 4.
Mm.
So if the polyp is in the rectum, there's bleeding,
Correct, usually
confused with hemorrhoids, although they're quite distinct. What about other potential symptoms?
One of the most important is altered bowel habit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, altered bowel habit means, let's say, for example, if you normally go to the toilet once in 2-3 days, and now you go once a day, now your habit has changed. So it doesn't mean that, you see, a lot of people think that you need to go to the toilet every day in order for that to be considered normal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you normally go every 2-3 days, now you go once a day, it doesn't mean that you have become normal. You, in fact, have become abnormal because
right.
your bowel habit has changed.
Mm.
That tend to happen again in patients who have left-sided colorectal cancer. So change the bowel habit. Now, if depending on the size of the cancer, if your cancer is now quite big and is about to obstruct the lumen of your large intestine, then these people will have difficulty in passing motion. They sometimes can only pass a liquid motion. They don't pass the form stool because all this form, bigger stool can't really get past that stricture.
Mm.
Then these people can get bloating, they can get pain.
Mm.
If the cancer is on the right side of the colon, many of these people don't really have any symptom except they have symptoms of anemia because cancer, they can bleed.
Mm.
So if you have bleeding from the cancer, then eventually you lost enough blood and then you get anemia.
Mm-hmm.
Symptoms of anemia would be things like you feel very tired. When you walk up the stairs, you feel breathless.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be the symptom of anemia.
Mm. And the change in bowel movements from what is your normal, so that could actually be perhaps either going less frequently or more frequently,
mm-hmm.
but also it's whether you're constipated or having watery.
It can also be a change in the consistency of your stool. Yes.
Consistency. And also, when it comes to bleeding, the way a person would identify is by looking for blood in the stool. Is that right?
Correct, yeah. Mm. Now, if they are bright red, it tends to be lower down, nearer to your anus. But if they are further up, then sometimes your blood can be mixed with the stool as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, all these symptoms doesn't really tell you very much. At the end of the day, you still need to do some confirmatory testing to mm-hmm. make sure that these people really have nothing else but just hemorrhoid.
Okay. Mm. If we were to talk about screening, so it's more people who don't have symptoms, screening yeah. people who are otherwise healthy for presence of those benign polyps, right? I mean, the idea is yes. to sort of identify that before they turn into
cancer.
What kinds of screening methods are available here to do that?
The best, obviously, is what we call colonoscopy, which is a long tube mm-hmm. with a camera, and that particular screening tool is by far the best because you go in there, you can see everything inside your colon, and at the same time you can actually remove the polyp when you see the polyp, so you can actually do something about the polyp at the same time. So that's colonoscopy.
Yes.
That is the best, but to do colonoscopy can be expensive. It's very labor intensive because you need endoscopies, you need to train endoscopies. You may not have enough endoscopies to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
The only country that can do this very well is America. They do screening colonoscopy, but they have a lot of endoscopies, and some of these endoscopies, they do nothing else but screening colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
So they have enough people to do that. Most countries can't afford to because it's expensive and it's labor intensive. So the commonest screening tool is fecal occult blood, meaning you use a special kit and then you test your stool for blood which cannot be seen with naked eye.
Mm, okay.
So that is fecal occult blood. Sensitivity is about 60-70%.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad. Not the best, but it's not bad. So that basically is picking up blood that's been lost from a polyp. And if it is positive, then you go on and you do a second stage. Then you go on and do a colonoscopy. So that is by far the commonest screening test that most countries are using. Then, of course, you have all the other bit, like there is a CT colonography, which first came out in 2000 or late 90s, but that one didn't really take off because I think the sensitivity is not good enough. If you have very small polyp, you tend to miss them. You still need to do your bowel prep, which can be quite cumbersome for some patients, mm-hmm. so they don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing is they are not as good as your, you know, this stool occult blood. So that one is cheap and is widely available. Then there are some places, and this is not recommended, like, you know, in Malaysia, many of us, we especially in the lab, they actually, you know, offer all these blood tests for mm-hmm. tumor marker,
yeah.
CEA, for example, but those are really not a very good test because the accuracy for those are about 20-40%.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you're actually missing most of the cancers if you use that test.
Mm, okay. Mm. So would you say that for somebody who's going for a blood test and that particular tumor marker is included, that they shouldn't take that as any indication of colorectal cancer?
I think there's no harm to do that, especially if you have absolutely no symptom. But I think one word of caution is if you are going to do that, you need to understand the value of all this tumor marker. For example, if you have symptoms and then you go on and you do this CEA, for example, then this test has come back as negative, then you may be thinking, have cancer, because I actually have come across patients like that.
Mm.
They actually have symptoms typical of colorectal cancer. They go to a lab, they do the blood test, and the blood test has come back negative, and then they say, thankfully, I don't have cancer.
Mm.
Then a month later, 2 months later, they say, I'm still no better, come see us. And in fact, I saw one such patient, and I say you needed a colonoscopy, so we went on to do a colonoscopy, and I say you have colorectal cancer. Then he said, but my test 2-3 months ago showed that I did not have any colorectal cancer.
Mm.
Then you tell them, the tumor marker is actually not very accurate because the accuracy is about 20-40%, then they got a shock of their life.
Yeah.
So I think if you're going to do a test, if you really want to screen for colorectal cancer, a stool or cord blood is actually a much better way to screen for colorectal cancer than tumor marker.
Okay. And when we come back from the break, we'll find out who should go for regular screening for colorectal cancer. And also, we definitely want to go into looking at treatment and what are the potential outcomes for people diagnosed with colorectal cancer. In the studio with me, Dato Dr. Tan Hak Ju, consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist from St. Gil GI Medical Center. We are talking about targeting colorectal cancer in today's show. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. I'm speaking to Dato Dr. Tan Hak Ju, consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist from St. Gil GI Medical Center today. We are talking about colorectal cancer, still ranking very high in Malaysia, according to our latest National Cancer Registry report. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dato' Tan, colorectal cancer is number one among males, number two among females.
Number three, I think, among females.
Sorry, number three.
After breast and cervical cancer.
That's right, number three among females. And, you know, the way colorectal cancer develops is that it starts out as benign polyps, either
correct.
In the colon or rectum or the
correct.
Anus.
Yes.
And what we want to do in order to detect it early is to identify the presence of those polyps.
Correct.
So you've said that you know, the most effective and accessible screening method, especially for people who are otherwise healthy and have no symptoms, would be the fecal occult blood test. Mm. And that's to test for very small amounts of blood in the stool.
Correct.
Where would this blood be coming from? It is already because the polyps are causing problems,
correct. Yes,
right?
They are. They will shed blood from time to time.
Mm.
They're very small amounts. So you're using naked eye, you can't really see them.
Mm.
But because this particular test, they actually test for those small amount of blood.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they are able to pick it up. Now, mind you, sometimes you can actually miss them using those tests because mm-hmm. they are cheap, they are easy to do. We use it, we do it as a screening.
Mm-hmm.
In most countries, you know, in Australia, in Singapore, so all these countries, they use fecal occult blood tests. They are cheap and they are simple to use. But you need to do it quite often. You need to do it every 2 years.
Okay.
So that if you miss it this time round, then next time you hope that you can actually pick it up.
Mm.
It's not the best test. We use it as a screening, like I said. But if you have symptoms, you should not go for this test.
Mm.
You go for a proper colonoscopy.
Yes. I mean, the best test, as you say, would probably be the colonoscopy, but then we are dealing with limited resources.
Correct.
Yeah. So who should go for regular screening?
Now, if you look at most countries, Western countries especially, you are doing a mass population screening. So that means you are dealing with a lot of people, not just patients. These are people, normal, healthy people without any symptom. So you need to set a target,
mm-hmm.
and the people used to use 50 years old as a target average risk patients.
Mm-hmm.
So most countries, they use 50. Some countries use 55.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the group that you most likely will pick up some polyps and then you can actually offer them something meaningful. You can remove the polyp and therefore you prevent cancer. Some patients, you can actually pick up early cancer. You offer them surgery, you cure them. But many people who started using 50 as a cutoff, especially in America, they find that they are now missing out a lot on younger patients who actually will later on develop cancer.
Mm.
So they lower the screening age to 45.
Mm-hmm.
This is by the American Cancer Society recommendation. I think that was last year or the year before. So now they have reduce it to 45, but different countries, depending on your resources, then that's
right.
when you decide what age you should start screening.
Mm-hmm.
50 years old, if you talk about, you know, average risk patients, 50 years old seems reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk about Asian, maybe you go 45.
Right, okay. Yeah. Are we, say, at higher risk?
There are some data to suggest that some of our patients are actually much younger, in their 40s. Mm. So I think, 45 is reasonable.
Okay. Actually, what could be causing colorectal cancer to show up in the in that younger age group, the 40s age group here?
Yeah. Genetic, like I said. Mm. So if you take a population at large, I think most places will recommend either 45 or 50. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, there are some subset of patients where you think they are at a much higher risk. Now, just now I talk about average risk just based on the age alone. But if you talk about some patients, let's say, for example, they have family history, mm-hmm. Then these are completely different subset of patients. For example, if you have a brother who developed colorectal cancer at the age of 35, mm. you need to start screening these people at 25. You right. actually minus 10 years.
Okay.
If you have a history of FAP, like for example, mm-hmm. What I talked about just now, where these people, they form polyps.
Mm-hmm. That's familial adenoma.
Polyposis.
Polyposis, yes.
Yeah, so these are this sort of family. Every single one of them needs screening, no matter what age they are, mm. even when they are in their teenage years, mm. you actually need to start screening for the polyps.
Okay.
Because these people, they can have hundreds of polyps. And these people, you need to identify them early because many of these people, 20, 25, they already develop cancer.
Right. Okay. Mm. Hundreds of polyps.
Hundreds of polyps, mm. yeah, literally.
Mm. Mm. So when you screen and assuming they go for, if there's anything to further follow up with, you go for a colonoscopy, you find polyps, does every polyp have to be removed?
Yes, unless you're talking about those people with hundreds of polyps, which is rare, they are not common.
Mm.
But generally, when we do a colonoscopy, every single polyp that we see, we remove them because potentially that's how you get cancer. Remember what I said just now, all colorectal cancers start as a polyp, although not all polyps become cancer.
That's
therefore,
right.
There's no way you can tell which polyp will become cancer or which one will not become cancer. Therefore, every single one of them, you will remove them. And it's quite a simple procedure to remove.
Okay. So what happens after the removal? Do you still assume that the person could have the average risk and still continue with regular screening?
Yeah, it depends on the size of the polyp, on the number of the polyps, and also the name of the polyp.
Mm-hmm.
I gave you quite a few names just now. Some of them much easier to become cancer, some of them not so easy to become cancer. So depending on the number, the size, and also the name of the polyp, then you advise the patient when to do their next colonoscopy.
I see. All right. And, there is still a high percentage of colorectal cancer diagnosed at late stage here in Malaysia. Can you briefly explain the stages to us, what they mean for the cancer, and why? Why are we still diagnosing them late?
Now, firstly, about why do we pick up later stage cancer? Now, later stage means, there are four stages. So you have a stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the importance of that are mainly related to survival. I'll talk about that later.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have symptoms, it tend to be somewhat in the later stage. For example, your stage 3 and 4, which is why if you look at the Malaysian data, most of our patients are diagnosed in stage 3 and 4. You're talking about almost 55 to 60% of our patients are diagnosed at this sort of stage.
Mm-hmm.
If you compare that to countries like America, they have about 48%.
Mm-hmm.
Europe is about 42%. So they are if you look at late stage cancer, Americans and Europeans, I think they probably have more accessibility to healthcare and also more awareness compared to Malaysians. If you tell them go do a colonoscopy or a fecal occult blood, most of them will look at you and say, "I have no symptom. Why should I do anything like that?" So
yeah.
I think public education is also very important. So this is the current state of our population in Malaysia, because most of them, they were, even after they have symptoms, they tend to drag.
Mm.
And this is why we pick them up later.
Screening
is an attempt to try and pick up early cancer, because if you pick up early cancer, you are actually literally looking at a cure. And when you pick up cancer at stage 3 and 4 particularly, to cure them is quite difficult. Yeah. So if you look at survival, stage 1, you're talking about 5-year survival of more than 90%. Stage 2, you're talking about more than 80%. But when it comes to stage 3, you're talking about 30 to 60%.
Oh, it drops drastically.
And if you are stage 4, 5-year survival, less than 10%.
Right.
So most of our patients, unfortunately, not so good, because we pick them up later, because that's when they have symptoms and then they drag and then they come to you and then you diagnose, you operate, and then you say, okay, this is your stage. And most of them would be, unfortunately, in that category.
Right. So what are the treatment options, you know, that obviously you would determine that based on their stage, wouldn't it? So, you know, for the early stages, and for you to be able to attempt curing the cancer, is it just a matter of surgery to remove?
Yeah, I think most of these patients will require surgery, depending on their health status. Let's say if they are quite healthy, even though they are a bit older, you would still offer them surgery, because that is probably the best option for a cure. And if you are lucky, and if your staging turns out to be stage 1 or 2, then most of these patients, you are able to cure them. Even stage 3, you still need to do the operation. And then hopefully after that, followed by chemo, sometimes targeted therapy, sometimes immunotherapy. Then again, a lot of these patients, you are able to offer them a cure. Then obviously stage 4 is the most difficult. We still offer them surgery in some cases. Because really, your best option to get rid of the disease is actually to remove the primary, followed by chemo, immuno, or targeted therapy, because those areas are moving very fast and they are improving a lot in the last 10 years or so.
Right. Can we talk a little bit about that, on the immunotherapy and targeted therapy, and how much have they sort of changed the landscape for treating advanced cancer?
No, I'm not the expert in that, because normally after we do the surgery, we normally would ask them to go and talk to one of the oncologists. So oncologists would be the best person to answer that. But for stage 4 in the past, you know, if you look at survival rate for stage 4, you'd be talking about less than 1%. But now, you know, some studies, if you look at them, some of them go up to about 8%, 9%, 10%. Chemotherapy plus minus immunotherapy or targeted therapy, because nowadays they actually they send off all sorts of genetic studies and all that. So based on that, then they can give you the appropriate treatment according to your, you know, they look at this MSI stability, etc. So those are very important markers for the oncologist to decide which drug will suit you best. Because of the advances in all those targeted therapy and immunotherapy, many of these people in the past, they would have actually, they would not have survived that long. But nowadays, because of that, it has really made a big difference.
But surgery will be that first response.
Well, we do surgery for many reasons. One is for cure. If you hasn't got a metastatic disease, meaning your disease has not spread to your liver, to your lung, etc. So one is for that purpose. Second is, some of these people, they are obstructed. So if you are obstructed and if you are still quite suitable, meaning you are not too sick, if you are still you are still able to take the surgery, we will still recommend surgery. If you are really frail and all that, obviously that's not really a good option. So you need to do surgery or sometimes do a stent to sort out the stricture or the blockage.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, they have excessive bleeding. Or if you have perforated, then obviously you need to do the surgery. If you are bleeding if there's no other way to stop the bleeding, then surgery again is an option.
Okay. And what have been the advances in surgery that have improved the outcomes for patients?
Rectal cancer, for that matter. If you look at the studies in the last maybe 5-10 years now, rectal cancer, especially if they are very big, nowadays what we do is we actually do a chemo radio, you string them, then you go in and do the surgery, followed by more chemotherapy. Many of these people, by doing that, you actually manage to cure these people. In the past, we tend to go in, do surgery first before you do the chemo radiotherapy. But now for rectal cancer, especially those nearer to the anus, this is what we would normally recommend.
Mm. And I think a lot of that fear still lingers about going through colorectal surgery. And, you know, the idea of having to perhaps have a colostomy, have the bag. What reassurance can you offer patients?
If you go to the correct colorectal surgeon, nowadays there are a lot of people who out there who can actually give you a temporary colostomy. So these people don't really need to do APR. APR is a surgery that give you a permanent colostomy and then close off your anus.
Mm.
So those are not very popular among patients because you need to have a bag for the rest of your life. Now, because of the chemo radiotherapy, so this is what they do nowadays, the surgeon. So they do chemo radiotherapy, shrink it, and then even if the cancer is very close to the inner verge, so that margin is actually very important. Sometimes even 2 centimeters or 3 centimeters away from the inner verge, these people are able to do an ultra-low anterior resection to remove your cancer, give you a temporary bag, sort out your cancer, chemotherapy, etc. 3-6 months later, go back, and then they are able to reverse it. So meaning you only need to carry your colostomy bag for about 3 to 6 months.
Mm, okay, much more promising.
Yes.
What are the chances of recurrence, though?
Because of the advances in the chemotherapy and all those targeted therapy and immunotherapy, chances of recurrence is a lot less nowadays compared to in the past. Rectal cancer, like I said to you just now, the way we practice it now is very different from how we used to practice it 10 years ago. The whole purpose is when you do that, you actually reduces your risk of recurrence.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you talk about stage 1 and stage 2 disease, they are less likely to come back, especially if you have done a good surgery with a good margin free of cancer, followed by chemotherapy. If you are stage 2, normally you don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
2B, sometimes you will need chemotherapy depending on your age. The difference is actually not that much. I think it's about 6% benefit or advantage.
I see.
So stage 2, if you are young, stage 2B, if you are young, sometimes oncologists will say, please go for it. But if you stage 3, definitely you should go for it because that will reduce your risk of a recurrent disease.
Mm, okay. We are talking to Dr. Tan Hak Ju, consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist from Sengil GI Medical Center today about colorectal cancer. When we come back, some hope on the horizon, hopefully. Let's look at what research is looking into in terms of being able to identify the risk factors, making better connections, especially for prevention, as well as anything promising with regard to advances in therapies as well. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. I'm speaking to Dato Dr. Tan Hak Ju today. He's a consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist from St. Gil GI Medical Center. We are talking about targeting colorectal cancer, targeting it on all fronts, I suppose. The most important would be targeting it early, being able to pick up the benign polyps in the colorectal area before they develop into cancer. And that the most effective way to do that would be through screening methods like the fecal occult blood test. Just to reiterate, Dato Tan, the fecal occult blood test would be suitable in the Malaysian setting for people above the age of 45 years old, to be done every 2 years. Let's look at ongoing research in colorectal cancer. Firstly, if we can look at what's happening in terms of our understanding of the dietary factors that lead to increased risk of colorectal cancer, what better knowledge do we have today?
Now, it has been said, firstly, I think if you want to prevent cancer, you remove polyp. But if you want to prevent polyp, you can't really prevent polyp because that's genetic. You can delay the formation of your polyp by eating healthy. Eating healthy means lots of vegetables and fruits. Mm-hmm. If you eat less calories, if you eat less red meat, mm-hmm. if you do plenty of exercise, mm-hmm. if you avoid smoking, and if you don't drink plenty of alcohol. Mm-hmm. So all these things that people has put forward in the past. Mm-hmm. Now, exactly how good it is in terms of evidence, not sure, because nobody can really quantify that. There has been research to look at drugs that has been used to reduce the risk of polyp formation. Mm-hmm. These are particularly useful in patients where you know that they form a lot of polyps in a short period of time. So things that has been looked at would be aspirin. So aspirin is one drug that mm-hmm. has been used. Aspirin is cheap. A lot of people take aspirin for many other reasons. Mm-hmm. For example, if you have had ischemic heart disease, mm-hmm. if you have had stroke in the past. Mm-hmm. So aspirin has been studied, and there was some evidence to suggest that it may be useful long-term to prevent polyp. Mm-hmm. There are some painkiller that has been used. It's COX-2 inhibitors. But all these are experimental still. They mm-hmm. were experimental a few years ago. I don't think it is a standard practice as yet.
Right.
For any country, to be honest, for that matter.
I see.
So some drugs has been tried, but I think some good evidence, but no countries has actually adopted that particular practice yet.
Okay. What about research on particular foods that may have protective effects? Yogurt has been singled out, for instance.
People talk about yogurt, people talk about probiotics. But again, all this evidence are not very strong. Mm. People talk about plenty of calcium, antioxidant, but I don't think there's anything concrete. Mm. I guess there's no harm in taking those because what's the worst thing that can happen? It doesn't work, but it doesn't really harm you.
Mm, mm. Okay. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are very excited about sort of the role of the gut microbiota as well. Is there any research looking specifically at how we could improve the gut microbiome?
No, there are loads of research, and especially in all this gut microbiome. But again, like I said, the evidence wasn't concrete. Mm. There are a lot of trials going on, in fact. But so far, I don't think there's any good papers or good publication to say, yeah, this is it. You take more of this and therefore you reduce your risk of polyp and therefore colorectal cancer. There isn't.
Okay. You know, one of the things that people like to pass around as well is that drinking 5 glasses of water a day can reduce your risk of colorectal cancer.
I think it is good, useful, but don't think the evidence is there.
Mm. Mm. No harm in doing it, but not that it's going to be particularly protective with colorectal cancer. I mean, ultimately, It comes back to the same things, like you said, eating healthily, eating a diet high in vegetables and fruits. I feel like we shouldn't need more evidence to tell us that would be a good thing.
Yeah, because I think by doing that, I mean, even if you don't cut out your risk of colorectal cancer, at least it's good for your heart. We know that that's good for your heart. Exercise plenty, cut out smoking, avoid too much alcohol, because that again is good for your heart. It's good for your liver, for example. Mm. So yeah.
Okay. Just a final message. We in Malaysia, we are still obviously battling with colorectal cancer being a high-ranking cancer. Among the population, we're still struggling to identify people at early stages. But at the same time, there's promising research and advances in therapies. Overall, how would you say the outlook for patients with colorectal cancer is changing?
I think if you pick them up early, and this is why most countries are now investing a lot of money in screening and picking up early cancer, because when you pick up early cancer, you can avoid all this expensive treatment like chemotherapy or immunotherapy, targeted therapy. All these are very expensive.
Very. Mm-hmm.
So if you put in more money in screening and picking up early cancer, all you need is, in fact, you can even prevent cancer by removing polyp.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why most countries who can afford that, they actually are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there good other screening tools? There are. People are looking at fecal DNA tests. Is there a good blood test that we can do? Right now, not yet. There are some research going on in America. John Hopkins, I think they actually came up with something that says that, it can actually screen for quite a few cancers using a blood test.
Mm-hmm.
But those are experimental. So hopefully that will come eventually. You need something simple, something that is acceptable to a general population.
Mm-hmm.
Colonoscopy is good, but it's invasive. You need to take time off. You need to, do a bowel prep. Mentally, many people say, I'm not prepared for mm-hmm. that. So it's not so appealing to general public. So if you look at, take-up rate for screening tests, colorectal cancer take-up rate is actually not all that high compared to, say, if you use, mammogram for mm-hmm. breast cancer. Pap smear for cervical mm-hmm. cancer. Those pick-up rate are much higher. The take-up rate much higher compared to colorectal cancer take-up rate in countries where they actually do a lot of, government put in a lot of resources to try and educate the public. In America, you're talking about 50-60% take-up rate.
Now, wow.
Those are bases where they actually do a lot of advertising and the doctors there tell you need to go and do your screening colonoscopy.
Mm.
In places where they don't do that, It's not very acceptable. People simply don't like to go to a doctor.
Yeah, and the idea of a colonoscopy, there's taboo and that fear attached to
correct,
it.
Correct, yeah.
Just for a start, where can people go for the fecal occult blood test?
Any lab. And in fact, in many countries, they actually send you, like in Australia, they actually send you the kit, and then you just need to put your stool there, and then you send it back to some designated lab mm-hmm. or whatever, and then mm-hmm. they will do the test for you, and mm-hmm. if it's negative, then they don't do anything. If they are positive, they will send you the result, and then they will say, please go and make an appointment for your colonoscopy. Then I think they send you a reminder like a month later or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Australians are doing quite well in terms of doing their screening for colorectal cancer.
And here, presumably also any lab or
hospital? Yeah, any lab, go to a GP clinic, these places, they can do that for you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Dato' Dr. Tan Hak Ju, consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist from St. Gilt GI Medical Centre, about colorectal cancer. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.